Feely.
And Keely.
At your service.
You must be Mr. Boggins.
No, you can't come in. You've come to the wrong house.
What?
Has it been cancelled?
No one told us.
No, nothing's been cancelled.
That's a relief.
Careful with these. I just had them sharpened.
It's nice, this place. Did you do it yourself?
Well, no, it's been in the family for years.
That's my mother's glory box. Can you please not do that?
Keely, come on. Give us a hand. Mr. Dwalin.
Let's shove this in the hallway, otherwise we'll never get everyone in.
Hey, everyone? How many more are there?
Where do you want this?
Oh, no.
No, there's nobody home! Go away and bother somebody else! There's far too many dwarves in my dining room as it is. If this is some clothead's idea of a joke, I can only say it is in very poor taste.
Get off!
Gandalf.
It's back to Middle-earth for us, and hope you brought a change of underwear, because it's going to be a long trip. We're talking, of course, about The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey on this week's episode. I'm Dan Persons. I'm here with Cinefantastique San Francisco Bureau Chief Lawrence French. Hey, Larry.
Hello there.
And joining us this week is BeABetterBookTalker.com's Andrea Lipinski. Hey, Andrea.
Hi, guys.
And this is the Cinefantastique Spotlight, science fiction, fantasy, and horror film in review. And CFQ Managing Editor Steve Bedrowski is en route. Hopefully he shall be with us presently, and we shall patch him into the conversation when he does arrive. But until then, let's talk about The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey. This is, of course, Peter Jackson's first installment, adapting the classic J.R.R. Tolkien novel. Is it regarded as a YA book, Andrea?
It is, actually. This is one of those rare books that is in all age sections of the library. Mm-hmm. It's in children's rooms. It's in young adult sections. It's also in adult and classic sections.
Bless J.R.R. He's got them all covered. So let me just sum this up quickly. Bilbo Baggins, played by Martin Freeman in the film, joins the wizard Gandalf the Grey, once again played by Ian McKellen, and a troop of dwarves as they march to reclaim their mountain kingdom that was long ago claimed by the dread dragon Smaug. And that's pretty much the story for this chapter. You will get the encounter with Gollum, played once again by Andy Serkis, and the Ring of Power will show up, and there are encounters with trolls and orcs and visits by the wizards Saruman the White and Radagast the Distraction, Radagast the Brown, and, well, that's it. And, you know, I had actually wanted to bring this up a little later in the show, but since we are waiting for Steve, and Steve was actually the odd man out in this aspect, let's talk about the big, big push on this film, which is the use of what's being called HFR, otherwise known as high frame rate, to exhibit the film. HFR essentially means that they're running at a frame rate. Usually it's 24 frames per second. In this particular case, it's 48 frames per second. Now, in a weird reversal for this type of thing, Steve was the one who didn't get to see it in that format. And all three of us have, and Andrea quite by accident, right, Andrea?
Yes, entirely by accident. For the second time, and by the way, both times it was the fault of Cine Fantastique, because mm-hmm. it was a movie I was seeing for opening weekend. I ordered my 2D tickets online, showed up at the theater, and was surprised when the guy handed me 3D glasses. And I said, oh no, what happened? So yeah, you know, that was like, oh, my first thought was, oh crap, I'm seeing this in 3D, and I've got 2 hours and... what was it? 45 minutes? 50 minutes?
Yeah.
Of a 3D movie, which was going to be bad enough. And then I said, I wonder if I'm in one of the theaters that's showing the high frame rate. I wonder if I'll be able to tell. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Before we go further with this, let me just say that if you've been paying attention to the industry at all, you know there were some bad vibes accompanying this system even before. I believe it was... way earlier this year, they had screened a few minutes of the film for the exhibitors convention in, I think it was Las Vegas, and got back very bad feedback from that. The operative phrase there was soap opera, which is not a good comparison when you're talking about a visual image. Now, I will say this. I was really looking forward to this. I was excited about it because it's a new technology. This thing goes back even further than digital technology. Doug Trumbull was a proponent of projecting films at a higher frame rate. His technique that he came up with was called show scan. It managed to get into some venues as a sort of a theme park thing, but never made it as a feature film format. So, but it's been a long time coming. It's supposed to create a heightened reality. It's supposed to create a more believable film image by eliminating the flicker and also pretty much eliminating the grain, which I guess gets blurred within the speed of the projection. So I came into this looking forward to seeing a brand new technology, and I have to say all the advance word very, very sadly was right. And not just that, but it was, in fact, so bad, so flat, so artificial-looking that it really, for the first 2 hours, took me completely out of the film. I couldn't get around it. I couldn't concentrate on the story itself. What was your experience, Andrea?
Well, yeah, I mean, it kind of, like I said, I noticed it within the first minute. And, you know, you didn't notice it in every scene, but you would notice it sometimes in crowd scenes where there are lots of characters. You'd notice it when the camera suddenly panned quickly from one character, like went right over to another character. I'd go, oh, it was like, it was disorienting. And yeah, I mean, it really depended on each scene. I understand the comparison between it looking like a soap opera. It also reminded me a little of like the 1960s Dark Shadows, mm-hmm. like that sort of quality of film. But then at the same time, other parts of the movie, or sometimes the same parts of the movie, which was even more disorienting, reminded me more of like a video game. You know, where they have like Worlds of Warcraft and stuff, mm-hmm. where they have those animated characters that look eerily realistic. It was like that. Parts of it looked eerily realistic. And I don't know. I mean, who am I to question, you know, Peter Jackson? But all right.
Go ahead.
but I question it. like just parts of it were, I don't know. Maybe it did make some of the effects better. You know, like I said, I don't see a lot of 3D movies, and when I do, it's mostly by accident. Mm-hmm. So I can't say that it makes 3D technology better or worse. I'm saying 3D tends to make me dizzy, and I don't know if this made me dizzier or not. Mm-hmm. I do know that I really, the number of times that I legitimately felt much more disoriented was when the camera panned quickly. And maybe there's a certain amount of blur that we're used to. and seeing every iota. You know, it's like when you watch TV and you used to watch David Letterman, and then suddenly you watch David Letterman in HD, and you go, oh, I don't
know. He's old.
Oh, look at the pores. Look at the pores. They're coming at me. I mean, there's some things you don't need to see.
Larry, you know, Andrea makes an interesting point about Dark Shadows that I want to get back to, but let me get your overall impression. And I'm curious about this because, just to jump ahead, when we were talking about the film last week, you had seen it at, was it 24p 3D that you saw it originally?
I saw it first in regular 3D,
okay.
24 frames.
24. And okay.
It was fine, and then I saw it again last week in the high frame rate, and that, like you, I had already seen the film, and the high frame rate just did not work for me, and it pulls you out of the story, and it's almost, if you go to see a 3D film, it takes you maybe 5 minutes to adapt to the 3D, and this, as you say, it's very distracting all the way through the film. I think it works much better in the action sequences where there's a lot of cutting, because then it's not as apparent. But really, in some static scenes where there's not a lot of movement, the characters look like they're in high definition video, and it's almost like it's detracting from the film. So I would recommend nobody see it in 48 frames per second until, you know, if this should somehow become the norm, you know, you might get used to it. But right now, I can see why people are upset, because it doesn't look like film. It looks like video.
Yeah, I want to get back to that too. But let's go back to what Andrea was talking about with Dark Shadows, because it's an interesting comparison, and I hadn't thought of this before. But the thing about Dark Shadows was that they were trying to do essentially the horror film atmosphere on a TV stage with the video technology that they had then. And by horror film atmosphere, what I am talking about essentially is the German expressionist type photography that the German cinematographers brought to America back in the 30s and 40s. And Larry, I think you would agree, you know, watching the previous Lord of the Rings trilogy, that Peter Jackson leaned heavily on the expressionist techniques for a lot of the film. The lighting at particular moments, the cinematography really harkened back to that. Would you agree with that, Larry?
Well, for some of it, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of it is outdoors in bright sunlight,
yeah,
too. But obviously in Shelob's Cave and Return of the King and things like that, yes, they're very, very, it's very dark and horror film-like, and, you know, when you've got a giant spider, you don't want to put it in bright sunlight anyway. So there's obviously all the scenes in the Mines of Moria and things like that, and in this film in the Great Goblin's Mine. So, you know, that's quite true. It's very dark and moody, right, photography. And I think the 3D works wonderfully for that. But the high frame rate, as I said, does not. It just, you know, it makes it look flat.
Here's the thing. Let me just lay this out, and then you can respond. Here's the thing, is that he tries the same things here, and it really it fails him here. I'm thinking in particular the sequence in Rivendell where Galadriel, Kate Blanchett, gets introduced. He introduces her framed in this archway with the light, with the backlighting and all of that, and that misty sort of look. It is a very architectural, expressionist type of moment, and it looks fucking fake.
Well, you know, that's the problem is you saw the high frame rate version first, and I didn't. So I thought that moment was magical when I saw it
I'm
the
sure.
first time. But it was, you know, in fact, her introduction, I really love that because it's just like a classic introduction and it's like you're visiting old friends you remember from the first movie again. But you're right, in the high frame rate, it sort of screws it up because everything looks so flat. And it's also the, you know, the some of the backdrops, which in normal 3D look gorgeous, here they tend to flatten out. It almost looks like there's a fake backdrop. Yeah. Which, you know, a lot of it is fake because they're matte paintings and green screen set extensions. So they, I think this just serves to highlight that. So it's in a way, it's really damaging to the film.
Yeah, you can you can clearly tell the green screen when it shows up, can't you?
Yeah, there's a lot of scenes like that. So it works even in when they're in the natural landscape. Sometimes the 3D seems to work against the high frame rate. And you know, you would think it would be better because one of the problems with 3D is there's not enough light on the screen, and this would presumably give you more light. But it also apparently serves to differentiate the planes into a much greater degree, I would say.
Mm-hmm. You know, Andrea, you brought up video games before, and that's a very apt comparison, particularly with the computer-generated and motion-captured characters in this film. A lot of it looks like cutscenes from a video game. And I'm wondering, you know, Peter Jackson is a big proponent of this. I think the original proponent of this was James Cameron, who has been pushing for this higher frame rate to be introduced to theaters. And I'm wondering if he knows something we don't. You know, we're sort of on the other side of the age divide. There is a whole other generation who has been weaned on video and video games. And I'm wondering, you know, if what bothers us is the is our indoctrination into classic filmmaking, the photochemical process that comes with the frame flicker, that comes with the grain, that is the natural process by which you make film. And so whether somebody on the south side of 30 might look at this and go, wow, this is just like what I want to see.
I mean, I definitely think that this film might look cool to teenagers who spend several hours each day playing video games, but to us grown-ups that it looked fake and it felt overwhelming, and my eyes were literally tired after this movie because it was just, I don't know, like too much stimulation, too much to look at, too many, I don't know, all the frames were tiring me out. I just thought it was funny because when, you know, I got to the theater and I was there watching the trailers, and they have the trailers, but then they also have those things that are before the trailers that aren't exactly trailers. They're mm-hmm. like ads. And a lot of those were for video games. So I would watch something and go, oh, is this like another, not another sequel to The Hobbit, but is this, you know, something like another fantasy movie? And then they'd cut to, this is World of Warcraft, you know, available now. And that's what a lot of the movie looked like, was like, I feel like I'm watching a video game. But it was just, I guess it was also kind of jarring seeing, and I don't know if it's the difference between when things were light or dark, or when things look like a video game, or they look like a, you know, 1960s soap opera. It kind of reminded me of, there was this thing that they used to do on Monty Python, mm-hmm. on the TV show, and you wouldn't really notice it that much at first, but they would film things differently if they were interiors or exteriors.
Yeah, the rostrum camera.
And then one time on one episode, or at least one that I remember, they made fun of that. So they're all yes. inside, and then they go outside, and they're like, wait a minute, now I'm on film. And then they'd go yeah. back inside, and then the film was different. And that was what made me, as a kid watching that, aware of like, whoa, wait, what just happened? Yeah. Oh, wait, no, it's a different – so that's what it felt like.
Weirdly, I've always been finely tuned to being able to detect video and film. By the way, Andrea, if you've been watching, if you used to watch Doctor Who regularly, you must have seen, because that's the way they did location shoots.
You mean like the old Tom Baker stuff?
Yeah, the old Tom Baker stuff is if they had to go outdoors, it was film. If it was in the studio, it was video.
Yeah, no, I grew up with that. So that was also kind of what it reminded me of being jarring. But I have another question that you guys will be able to help me understand. If this was a 3D thing that I'm not used to, or if the frame rate made it worse, there were like four or five times during the movie that I thought that someone in the theater was standing up in front and blocking the screen. And like you want to do that, you know, hey, down in front. And then I'd realized, no, that's something in the foreground. But it looks so huge that it was like hard for me to focus on what's this big thing going on over there and then what's this big black thing suddenly in my field of vision.
Larry, what about you?
Well, that would be, I would call that effective use of 3D. Yeah. But if it's, you know, I don't remember seeing anything like that when I saw it. So it may have actually been, because, you know, pretty much everything in the foreground was fairly well defined. So you should have been able to tell that it was whatever it was, I would think.
Weirdly enough, they did run the Star Trek 9-minute teaser preview. Not really a teaser. It's the first 9 minutes of Star Trek Into Darkness. But this never happens to me, but there was one point during the film where Kirk and McCoy are running from some aliens, and they throw a spear, and they do the old bit of, you know, the spear coming out of the screen in 3D. It's the first time ever I actually flinched.
Uh-huh. It was coming right at you.
It was coming, seriously. Seriously.
As long as you didn't duck or leap out of your seat.
Almost. Almost. I almost leapt out of my feet during the I almost leapt to my feet during the first few minutes of The Hobbit, going, I've made a terrible, terrible mistake. Let's just forget I was here.
So Larry, was it worse for you? Because weren't you seeing it in an IMAX?
No, so I had seen it first and liked it in the regular format, mm-hmm. 3D, and then I saw it the second time. Not in IMAX, but in high frame rate 3D.
Oh, Dan, you saw it in an IMAX?
I saw it in IMAX, yeah.
So you saw what we saw, only bigger?
Only bigger, except that I was all the way in the back of the theater, which wasn't too much of a problem.
Okay.
As far as that goes. Let me wrap this up and we'll get to the discussion of the film now, and hopefully Steve will show up at some point. But Larry, I wanted to ask you a bit of a philosophical question. You know, this sucked. As far as HFR is concerned, or as I'm now calling it, Huffer. And didn't they pick a great acronym?
I don't know if it's great or not.
It is not. I'll answer that question. It is not. But in any case, you know, this, what we saw with the high frame rate with The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey really did suck. But does that then indict the technology? Is this the situation similar to what happened when color was introduced to film, and, you know, those first films, you could scorch your retina if you stared at it too long? They're going, you know, like, wow, you know, we've got to make sure people understand that they're paying their money's worth and getting this new technology. Is this the same thing here? And is there the possibility that hopefully the technology is going to mature and mellow as we go on?
Well, that's a good question, because, you know, this doesn't necessarily mean it's look bad to us, but it could be just because we're not used to it, number one. Or number two, perhaps the frame rate working with 3D, it doesn't work very well. I've never seen a higher frame rate than 24 frames per second with a normal 2D film, so I'm not sure like what a show scan film would have looked like. Mm-hmm. In high frame rate, in, you know, in regular 2D. Maybe it worked better in just regular 2D. And there's also another thing which Peter Jackson is talking about, which is variable frame rates. In fact, he's saying you, as filmmakers, can use this tool and use it for scenes where there's a lot of action and just, you know, shoot in a slightly higher frame rate for selected scenes within a movie. And with digital projection, that will be easily, you know, easy to accomplish that. And because, as I was saying before, you know, the sort of static scenes, it just becomes way too jarring for me. So if you shot the action sequences this in high frame rate and left the others at the regular rate, it might be much more effective. And the other thing is, it could be just that it's too fast. Maybe they should use, you know, why, how they pick 48 frames is a mystery. Maybe it should be 36 frames mm-hmm. or 32 frames. But, you know, 24 frames does seem to be the rather low for a projection. So
I can answer that to a certain extent, is that 48 frames would, if I'm not mistaken, I may actually be wrong here. 48 frames would be base 8. I don't think it's base 16, though, which is the usual for digital. In any case, let's move on with that. And let me just say that Steve Bodrowski, managing editor of Cine Fantastique, has now joined us. Hello, Steve.
Yes, Elvis is in the building.
Hey! Woo! Woo! Okay, so it's like waiting for the Stones to arrive. And so so let's go on. Steve, you know, you lucky bastard, you missed the HFR.
Yeah, sorry. I saw it at an awards screening, so to speak. They're hoping to get nominated, obviously. I doubt they're going to get too many nominations.
No, but we'll see. No. So in any case, let's move on and talk about the film. And let me address this to Andrea first. Okay, we did the technology up and down now, and we were all disappointed in that. But let me go a little bit further and say, Andrea, this is awful. Okay? My problem with it is that, aside from the technology, and I will say, as I pointed out before, what's killing me is that I can't tell how much of my problem was with the HFR and how much of the problem was with the film itself. But I can tell you that my sense of the film was that there was no storyline to speak of in this film. It was bits and moments. The major through line that I could find in the film was the idea of Bilbo wanting to belong to this this group that was going to reclaim the Lonely Mountain. And when your big budget 3-hour film relies on a storyline taken from an after school special, I think you're in trouble, Andrea.
Ouch. Well, see, the problem, I mean, we were all wondering, everyone was wondering, wait, how are you going to take this novel that is long but not that long and make it into 3 movies? And now we know. We're going to take parts of the novel, and then we're going to insert other stuff, and all the other stuff kind of, you know, distracted from the novel. I mean, I'd reread The Hobbit in preparation for this, but I don't think that adequately prepared me for this movie, because I kept going, well, that's not in the book, that's not in the book, that's not in the book. Oh, yeah, here we are. Okay, now we're back at the book. Okay, now we're back at the book. But then even, like, there was some stuff that was in the movie that was really loyal to the book, like characters breaking out into song. And I mean, that happened in the other books too, but I mean, that was something that wasn't always translated into movie versions. A lot of times they would just kind of ignore that. But here, when characters would sing, the characters would sing, and that was respectful of the source material. I'm not saying it's a good idea or a bad idea, that might have had a very mixed reception, but it was loyal to the source material. Other parts were like, okay, we're going to ignore The Hobbit altogether, and we're going to take something from the appendices, or we're going to take something from Tolkien's diaries, or wherever they got it from. And then some things were like, oh, this is from the book, but it looks like they decided to make it cooler. And that was just distracting too, because it's like, well, that's not what. Why did you add in that character? Why did you change the scene of where that took place? Why did you make this happen at that time instead of at that time? So I don't know. It was just, you know, the Battle of the Rock'em Sock'em Rock Monsters, you know,
the stone giants.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the white orc who has it in for Thorin, that whole, you know, subplot running through it, Radagast running around on the sled pulled by bunnies. Okay. That was adorable, but you know, it was
they
like,
should have
what?
Released this for Easter.
Yeah, well, but it was like, what would be cooler? You know, hey, let's add this and this and this. So, you know, I kept feeling like what I read to prepare for this didn't prepare me enough. And now I'm like, well, if you want to stretch it out, it's like you're thinning out the original material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like they stretched it and they padded it at the same time.
Steve, what was your reaction?
Okay, if I may quote or paraphrase myself, my review.
Oh, go ahead.
There's so much, you know, basically it's more, instead of adapting The Hobbit as The Hobbit, they're using it as a jumping off point to create a prequel trilogy that's going to do for Middle Earth what Star Wars, what happened to Star Wars with the prequel trilogy, what's going to do for Middle Earth what Star Wars did for the galaxy far, far away, which is probably ruin it. You know, basically it's an excuse to do more Lord of the Rings, and there's so much Lord of the Rings, there's not a lot of room left for The Hobbit. So essentially it's what Andrea is saying, you know, there's stuff in the appendix to Lord of the Rings, there are unpublished stories that came out later, like The Quest for Erebor, in which Gandalf explains, oh yeah, you know, the dwarves just wanted to reclaim their homeland, but I was worried about Smaug becoming allied with Sauron. So it's essentially, you know, they're adding in all this exposition to tie The Hobbit into the Lord of the Rings films. And what should be the story is Bilbo Baggins, this quiet little hobbit from the quiet little Shire, but with a bit more curiosity about the world at large, enough to make him maybe go along for this kind of a ride, you know, finds out that he's up to the task. Well, that's enough for one movie, one book and one movie, mm-hmm. but it's not enough for three. So they got to, you know, artificially create some other climaxes and other stuff going on. And every once in a while, it gets back to the Bilbo story. And when it does, it's usually pretty good. I mean, the riddles in the dark sequence between him and Gollum is one of the few moments when I was actually engaged, as opposed to saying, well, why am I watching this? It mm-hmm. looks nice, but I've seen it all before. I mean, yeah, there's that white orc thing Andrea mentions. And obviously the intention was, hey, we started off Fellowship of the Ring with this scary monster thingy guy smiting a king, and that worked really well. How can we do that again in The Hobbit? Okay. And then by the end, well, you know, the end of Fellowship of the Ring was we're standing on a hill looking at the scary mountain that we're trying to get to. And, ooh, how does The Hobbit, the first part of The Hobbit end? Same thing. It's more a remake than a prequel even.
Larry, you know, Steve says, you know, it's a bunch of other stuff. The thing is that it struck me that it's all other stuff. This felt to me like 3 hours of Dinosaur Stampede, if you understand the reference.
King Kong.
Yes. Exactly. Am I missing something, Larry?
Yes, I think you are. And the thing is, The Hobbit is, well, I had read it when they first announced that he was going to remake this, and I was rather surprised because it's so juvenile compared to the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So it's like, well, if you want to make a kiddie movie, that's one thing. But, you know, why should he be slavish to this material? I think he did a wonderful job inserting the appendices. And if you know the appendices, they make perfect sense. So when, for instance, the scene with where they come to the White Council at Rivendell, I thought that was gorgeously shot. And it's like a visiting old friends. You get to see Galadriel again and Hugo Weaving as Elrond. And, of course, Christopher Lee as Saruman. And I thought that material fits in perfectly for me, because if you know the other films, it's like, as I say, it's like visiting old friends again, and you're excited about it. Or at least I was. And, you know, that's to say that's out of place is I don't think it is at all. I think it works beautifully. And Radagast the Brown is a nice little touch, too, I thought. And, you know, so you have all these little chapters that are inserted there. And if it makes the film much less juvenile than the book is. So it's like, oh, it's in fact, it's rated PG-13. It's much more intense than the Hobbit would be if they filmed it as just one movie is straight. And I think that makes it much more into the feeling and the look of Lord of the Rings. And the other thing is, it's not just the same. It's not a remake. It's you get to go back to Rivendell and see all these other places that you hadn't seen in the first film. I think that was really great to see different settings and different types of the city and all these scenes.
So you see, here's the thing: is that you are holding that all of this that's been added adds to the richness of this first installment. I've got to fall in with Steve and Andrea that at some point it stops being adding depth and detail and just begins to feel like padding. There's a number of good things here that get added in, you know, the Battle of the Stone Cold Giants and that sort of stuff. But at some point, as you know, here again, I cited this last week, as Roger Ebert said, too much of a good thing. Larry, you did not feel that it was an overload of that sort of stuff?
Not at all. In fact, as I was saying, I thought it all the added sequences, the only thing that I thought was a little too much, you know, because you've got 12 dwarfs, it's a little too much. You don't really get to know them individually, you know, Thorin and Balin mostly, and then a couple of others. But, you know, that's with 13 dwarfs, they're just too much. But it's sort of like, you know, going on the trip with Jason and the Argonauts. You only know two or three people on the boat there either. So that's fine, too. It's just that it's a little bit overdone in the beginning because they're having this long sequence at Bag End. But I think it works beautifully in all the other scenes. And the whole backstory of, you know, Sauron is alive or is just starting to come back to Middle Earth. I think they don't introduce that yet, but it's going to obviously take up a big portion of part two, probably. And it's all, you know, if you know the stories, especially, I think it enriches that because you know what Gandalf is worried about. And you can even see the beginnings of Sauron becoming envious. He wants to really possess the ring, and he's played as a good wizard here, but we know he's going to turn bad. So I think that's very interesting, too.
Mm-hmm. Andrea, you went ahead, as you mentioned, you went ahead and read the novel. And how you also read the Lord of the Rings trilogy. How far along did you get in that?
I did not read the whole trilogy. I read the first one. I read the Fellowship of the Rings.
Okay. So,
I had also seen a couple of different movie versions. I could not get my hands on the 1977 version of The Hobbit, but I did see, you know, the first Peter Jackson the Fellowship of the Ring, and then I also saw the Ralph Bakshi one, which I am a closet fan of. Let me ask the other ones that Peter Jackson did, the other Lord of the Rings trilogy. Oh, mm-hmm. Sorry, somebody of the fat and furry persuasion is climbing on my lap. Sorry.
That's no way to talk about your boyfriend.
I'm trying not to. I have a microphone headset. Give me a second. Okay. I'm sorry. If you hear purring, that's not me.
That's
okay.
It. You know, all things stop for it. Love me.
Yes. Hey, look, at least they didn't pad out the running time with extra stories about Tom Bombadil. So
we all covered that before. Yeah.
But others in the trilogy, were those also PG-13?
Yeah, I believe they were, weren't they?
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. They wouldn't have gone for R with these films. No, okay. No freaking way. But let me ask you, because Larry does make the point that The Hobbit, more even than Lord of the Rings, was as a book, a more juvenile type of exercise. So what was the difference between your experience reading the book and seeing the movie, was there something lost in bringing it up to PG-13? Was something perhaps added?
No, I think it was a good compromise to make it PG-13, to make it more in line with the other books. I mean, the other, like, you know, The Fellowship of the Ring was just harder to get through because it was a denser book. I mean, that one took me just a long time to read, and The Hobbit is a much quicker read. So, yeah, I mean, I didn't mind that they, whatever, you know, upped the action or upped the violence or stuff like that, you know, in order to get them all kind of on par with a PG-13. I mean, it's virtually the same audience, you know, adults and kids and teens who were probably fans of the original, you know, of the original books and also of the way that Jackson interpreted the Lord of the Rings trilogy, who would be going to see this. So, no, I mean, having it PG-13 is fine with me.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve, you know, amongst the other things that they threw in were they do not shortchange you on the battle sequences. That's for sure, but I'm not exactly sure that that's an advantage. Really, it boiled down. After a while, I went through the brain shutdown thing again. Same thing for you?
I thought they weren't very good. And, you know, this is something I harp on. When we see stuff like this, there's this knee-jerk reaction to say, well, it's visually spectacular, but the story's weak. And I think, you know, it's not that visually spectacular. Good visuals would mean there was some suspense and you were engaged and you were, you know, afraid for the characters and, you know, you see the concern or the worry or the despair in their eyes before they figure out some way to escape. And that happens in the other films. I mean, you know, if you want to compare Fellowship of the Ring, there's a bit where Frodo and Aragorn are on a middle chunk of bridge and there's no way to go forward and no way to go back. And gravity starts to pull it forward and they kind of ride it down. And that's a really suspenseful sequence. There's similar stuff going on in here, but there's like more of it. You're not so much on eye level with the characters. You're seeing it at a distance. So it's this kind of domino thing of, you know, one bridge or staircase falls over and, you know, the CGI renderings of the characters leap in unison to the next platform and that falls over and they leap into the next one. And there's never a sense that anyone's in real danger. And I started coming away feeling about it, oddly enough, despite the, you know, luminous CGI renderings, it feels like a mid-60s era Toho Japanese fantasy science fiction film around the time when they stopped doing a lot of live action because that might make it too scary for the kids and said, well, we'll just stick to, you know, seeing the miniature buildings get knocked over. And that's kind of how I felt here. You know, it's pretty to look at, but it's not good visual storytelling. It's not even good action filmmaking or action painting or whatever you want to call it.
Larry, you know, there may be something to that. I can see Peter Jackson sort of getting, well, you know, considering the fact, oh, no, that's, I'm sorry, that's somebody else. Forget I started that sentence.
New thought.
But Peter Jackson Peter Jackson, I wouldn't be surprised if he was a fan of the Toho type films. Do you think he was perhaps leaning on that, referencing that?
Probably not that much, I don't think. I think, if anything, he's referencing his love of Ray Harryhausen. And, you know, this film, like the Lord of the Rings films, feel to me a lot like Jason and the Argonauts. I mean, there's all these monsters, and it's basically a quest, and they go and they meet, you know, first they meet the stone trolls, then they meet the stone giants, and then they meet the great goblin. And so there's all these set pieces that happen on the trip, and it's felt to me very much like a Ray Harryhausen movie in that regard. And he certainly is, you know, a huge fan of Ray Harryhausen, so I would think he would be much more influenced by that. Especially, I mean, take the stone giant sequence, which is only about two pages in the book, or less. And then he turns that into a scene that sort of reminded me of the clashing rock sequence in Jason and the Argonauts. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, and I thought it was very effective. If you didn't think they were in trouble there, you know, I think something's wrong. But I think especially the climax of the movie, which we'll talk about, I guess, in spoilers, I thought that was tremendously effective.
Andrea, let me add in a caveat to our discussion earlier about HFR. As I said, you know, I got completely taken out of the film by this, and one of the things that keeps me cautious about saying that the problem was completely the technology was that I went through the entire film, you know, and I'm going through it, and I, as I said, I'm just sitting there going over and over to myself, I made a big mistake. And then we get to the scene with Gollum, and boom, all of a sudden I'm invested in the film. You know, and not surprisingly, the scene with Gollum is one of the things that is at length from the book, but it completely engaged me. So, you know, I mean, did you find that about that sequence, that was sort of the standout sequence in the entire film?
Yeah, I mean, the conversation between Bilbo and Gollum was definitely one of the most engaging ones, you know, in the movie, because, you know, for 1 second talking about sort of the believability of, you know, the action scenes and if they take you out of it or not, I thought it's not like when you're watching Indiana Jones running away from the boulder, you understand it's a special effect, but you still feel like he could get crushed by that boulder and your heart is racing and you're sort of seeing the viability of how that would work. But it's like contrasting that to, you know, one of those James Bond openings where he escapes from something in such an elaborate way. And first you're buying it, and then like a minute or two in, you go, oh, come on. And some of the escape sequences in this movie were like that. I'd be like, yeah, well, that wouldn't happen. Well, that wouldn't happen. Well, that wouldn't happen. You know, but like, boom, you're there with Bilbo Baggins and Gollum, and they're just there talking. And, to me, that was one of the best scenes in the film. I guess my only issue with it was that Gollum is hard to understand. And some of those riddles are kind of complicated. And, you know, they were complicated for me reading them. But if you don't know the language that they're using, and even there's one point where, you know, the answer is like an egg, but instead of saying an egg, he says eggses. And if you didn't understand what he was saying, you'd be like, wait, what was the question? Wait, what was the answer? I mean, that was my only problem with that sequence. But the dialogue between them, the expressions on both of them, and just the way that Gollum was animated was just beyond fabulous, you know? And I mean, that was like a scene that you could – and that was the scene where I was most aware – and where I became aware of how many kids were in the audience, because a lot of times other things in the were happening on screen and the audience was quiet or just kind of laughing. But during the scene where he's talking and interacting with Gollum, suddenly I heard younger voices in the audience because they understood more of that and they were sort of laughing and going along with it or reacting or oohing or aahing or things like that. And that made me aware that, you know, it is really – that story does appeal to all ages. But if you're just watching things, you know, explode and go boom and – but, you know, watching things explode and go boom is kind of what we're set up for. I mean, I saw the trailers before the movie started. Half of them featured lots of shots of people jumping from great heights or falling from great heights. Apparently, the coming year will be filled with that's going to be the theme of movies that are coming up. So you just know that's like that's the audience. But also ads for World of Warcraft too. So that's the audience too.
Steve, you know, interestingly, I was talking to Ed Douglas of ComingSoon.net earlier today, and I had talked to him about the Gollum sequence, and I haven't checked this myself, but he was saying that this was actually the first sequence they filmed. And so, you know, they and possibly this was even before they made the decision to jump from two films to three films, and two films in the first place with this, I think, was a mistake even there. But the three films also was a mistake. But that seems interesting that the thing that helped me was the thing that they were coming into fresh. But what did you think of the sequence, Steve? I mean, despite all the Sturm und Drang of the rest of the film, is this actually the high point of the film?
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I hate to just agree with everyone and not have much new to add to it, but
no,
I mean, sincerely, you know, when I sat down to watch this movie, I was kind of guardedly optimistic because of all the concerns about padding it out, about the fact that the original text is quite a bit different in tone from Lord of the Rings, and how are they going to bridge that gap? And, you know, after about 20 minutes, I started thinking, you know, why was I ever even cautiously optimistic? This is just not engaging. It's like I said, spectacular to look at, but just not that interesting. And then suddenly when that sequence comes, you are engaged. You're interested in the characters and the interaction. And it effectively foreshadows events in Lord of the Rings without having to add anything to the movie that wasn't in the book. It's just inherent in the, you know, the obsessiveness and what we see is happen, what Gollum, his condition is after years of owning this ring and his reaction at the end, you know, hobbitses, we hates it forever. Yeah, that's clearly going to lead into what we see later without any real heavy-handed foreshadowing. And, you know, it's nice because, you know, as faithful as they are to the dialogue, there are things in the book they couldn't get, but you get something different in the special effects and the performances. I mean, the fun of the chapter, Riddles in the Dark, is Tolkien keeps telling us these riddles are real easy and saying, well, of course you've already figured this out by now, but Bilbo was, you know, really scared, so his brain wasn't working as fast as yours is. And I'm like, I'm not figuring any of these out, you know. They're pretty well beyond me. But not being able to get that across, you know, they did other things, just the atmosphere and the lighting that made that sequence work. And it is kind of funny that it plays out a little differently. You know, we do see Gollum lose the ring, which isn't from the story, and also contradicts the prologue that we see in Fellowship of the Ring, which shows Bilbo finding it in a cavern somewhere at a distance from Gollum. So I'm really dreading the thought that at some point in the future, Peter Jackson is going to go back and cut this sequence into
Fellowship
of the Ring.
He's going to Lucas that mother.
Yeah, I'm really worried. We're going to lose Ian Holm in the wig from the prologue, and they're going to replace him with Martin Freeman. And so I'm glad I have, you know, my DVD now, and I won't have to suffer through that.
You think he's going to pull a Tolkien and start rewriting stuff?
In our case, he's going to pull a Han shot first, not Han shot first, but Greedo shot first.
Yes.
There you go.
In this case.
More to the point, replacing Darth Vader or Anakin Skywalker at the end of Return of the Jedi.
True. Larry, back over to you. I mean, what do you think? I mean, despite everything else in the film, I mean, is this the thing that people will be remembering?
Well, I actually like the climax better than the Gollum sequence. And, you know, as Andrea pointed out, I had the same problem when he says Eggsies. I didn't understand that in the movie. And I had to, when I went home after seeing it the first time, I, you know, reread that chapter. And, of course, then it makes sense. But Gollum's sound mix was a little, because of the way he speaks, it's very difficult to hear his answers and make sense of them. And so on the second viewing, it made much more sense because I already knew what he was going to say. But I think it is a problem in if you're seeing it the first time, because you want to hear those punchlines to the riddles. And if you can't understand them, that's defeating some of the enjoyment. But, you know, Gollum has done he's certainly progressed in terms of the motion capture and animation. And they've done a really terrific job, obviously. Andy Serkis has done great work. And so has, you know, and the whole sequence is just really pretty fabulous.
Andrea, you know, Steve had mentioned in that sequence how artfully, how skillfully they did the foreshadowing in that particular moment. And that sort of casts in to highlight the foreshadowing that they do in the rest of the film, which is not so artfully done. And Steve, you've been making comparisons to the Star Wars prequels, and I think it is very apt in this particular case. I'm not sure if, you know, we have this term retconning. I'm not sure if we should have a term for the thing where the sequels that are prequels then try to foreshadow what's coming in the original film and maybe call that pro-conning. But, you know, it's sort of like that. But, Andrea, you know, the problem with me is that, you know, we don't need to see the backstory for everything. We don't need to have hints, you know. In the Star Wars things, we don't need to see where C-3PO and R2-D2 come from. You know, that doesn't add anything to it. And I think there's a similar situation here where they're setting up the stuff in The Lord of the Rings and they're showing us where it came from. And I don't particularly need or want to know that. How about you, Andrea?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, to me, I mean, but then if you cut out all that stuff, what would this be? One movie? Two movies?
Please!
I mean, then you wouldn't get... I mean, that's the very first thing I heard when I heard that The Hobbit was going to be three movies was, wow, that's greedy. That you're trying to get three times as many ticket sales out of one novel. Now, I understand. Look, if it's Harry Potter and, you know, if it's the last Harry Potter book that you could use as a friggin' doorstop, I don't mind to you taking an enormous story and breaking it down into two movies. I understand that. But if you take a not-so-enormous story and pad it out into three movies, you go, okay, is everybody going to be speaking very slowly? Or, you know, when they get the gold, are they going to be counting it out piece by piece? I mean, we were already theorizing about what's going to happen in book two, what's going to happen in book three. But the point is, if you're adding in all this other stuff into the mix, it's hard to even make a guess.
Mm-hmm. Steve, going back to my question here, I mean, do you think that they commit the sin of telling us about stuff that we really don't need to know about?
I, in general, don't think highly of prequels because mm-hmm. they're bound to do that. Otherwise, there's no reason for their existence. And worse yet, they're bound to do it in the course of a story that takes place over a limited amount of time when realistically these little bits and pieces would have accumulated over years, or in the case of a Middle Earth story, over millennia. so trying to fit them all into here, you know, is a bit dubious. I think it's an interesting exercise, and theoretically, you know, the idea like, oh, well, Tolkien wrote this book, but then he had to, you know, go back and rewrite the Gollum chapter after Lord of the Rings, and he wanted to, you know, rewrite other things. The idea of, well, let's take some of that stuff, incorporate it. It certainly sounds interesting, like it could be done. But as I said before, the result I see, as open as I was to the thought of, well, yeah, let's use this to tie in, you know, the result is the story of The Hobbit kind of gets, as I think you said, thinned out or diluted. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it doesn't work for me. And there's not the emotional connections to make the stuff interesting. Like I said, it does seem to get bogged down in exposition from time to time, rather like The Phantom Menace.
I guess part of the thing is that if you feel that you take this one book and you stretch it out into three movies, that you should get to know those characters really well because you're spending a lot of time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not. I feel like you're not spending enough time with The Hobbit. Have you looked at The Hobbit poster? The poor Hobbit can't even fit on the poster.
Oh, I got to go back and look now.
Look at the Hobbit poster. It's just the dwarves' faces.
Yeah, just look at the poster we posted with my review on the website. And it's like an army of dwarves. and there's no Hobbit. And the title is
like,
Great,
there's
the
17
Hobbit.
Different posters, so it depends on which poster you're looking
well,
at.
Well, obviously, I selected the one to make my point. You know?
Oh, okay. Well,
there's one with just Martin Freeman, too.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Right, with his phony warrior face.
Okay, the one on IMDb is the one I'm looking at, and that shows the, you know, all, like dwarf,
right.
dwarf, mm-hmm. yeah. But the other thing is, you know, there's stuff going on with the Hobbits, like you said. You know, like, one of them, you know, kind of well, you know, and then I'm reading these articles, like, oh, well, we think that this guy is going to be a breakout hit because he's cute. But, I mean, even the cute one firing the arrows gets, what, like 10 minutes of screen time in this, you know, three-hour-long movie? But I was reading on IO9 one of these things about, here are things that you don't know about the Hobbit. And you're like, okay. And then they said, well, one of the dwarves has an axe handle in his head. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah, that's why he speaks only dwarvish. And you're like, what? I mean, he got, what, like 2 minutes of screen time in 3 hours? And it's only because I read that article before that I went to the theater and that I was looking for that. But the point is, they're all furry and they all have hair hanging all over. And then you go, oh, I guess hanging under that hair, that thing in there, that's not his hair, that's an axe blade that's embedded in his head.
Oh, good Lord.
And that's why he speaks only dwarvish, but he has like 3 lines and you hardly notice that they're only dwarvish. I mean, so you put the time and effort and the makeup into that, but, you know, there's just so much stuff going on that, I mean, I feel bad for these characters that, you know, maybe some of them had like story arcs that you could have worked on or developed, but, you know, you were so busy with the, you know, running around with the bunny rabbit sled.
Larry, bad time to imitate Eric von Stroheim, you know, giving everybody silk underwear, even if you don't know it.
Well, that's, you know, these films are so rich in detail that things like that will have to wait to the special edition DVD when you add another half hour to the movie.
Oh, no, God, for fan. Larry, take it back. Take it back.
No, it's already been announced. He's going to do a special edition DVD.
You son of a bitch. Is there anything else we want to talk about before we go into spoilers? Anybody? Okay, so in which case, let's go into the spoiler section for The Hobbit and Unexpected Journey. This is the part of the show where we're going to talk about things about the film that you may not want to hear about if you haven't seen the film. So if you want to skip over this section, you can fast forward to
1 hour, 17 minutes, and 18 seconds.
And really, okay, this is your final warning, just in case we're in the spoiler section now. There's really only one thing that I have to say that's spoilers, and it's just fucking eagles. You know,
you have a problem with the eagles?
It's just that, you know, like Steve, like you said, you know, you like the butterfly and the eagle bit before. Well, here it is again. You know, and just on a technical question, how fast do those butterflies have to flutter in order to reach the eagles to get them to arrive in time?
They go through a wormhole.
Live nearby, yeah, so it's not that difficult.
Yeah, the eagles might have been right around the corner.
They're just hanging out, you know.
It's a magic land. It's Middle Earth. You know?
Okay.
I'm going to give him that. I'm going to give him that. You know, if I have other things to harp on, so I'll let him get away with that one.
Okay.
But yeah. But your essential point of like, yeah, the eagle rescue thing, except now it'll be not just one wizard. It'll be a wizard and a dozen dwarves and a hobbit.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's the same, but bigger.
Mm-hmm.
The Hollywood way. I think Peter Jackson has learned too much of the Hollywood way.
Well, you can't blame Peter Jackson for that. It's right out of the book.
Is it out of the book?
It is out of the book.
Oh,
it's right out of the book. So, in fact, I had completely forgotten about that. It's also very nice. I thought it was a wonderful sequence because, you know, he also introduces the character of Azog the Defiler and the pale orc who has a real feud with Thorin Oakenshield. So that gives them a real reason to hate each other. And, you know, I think that adds a lot of a lot of suspense to the climax. I mean, Thorin is about to die and Meanwhile, all the dwarfs are hanging off trees, and how are they going to possibly get out of this? So, and as Andrea was saying, a lot of these suspense films now take, you know, everybody's about to fall off a cliff or something. So, you know, that goes back to North by Northwest, and it goes back to the ending of Return of the King when Frodo's hanging off the edge of, you know, the cliff there. So I think it really works, those kind of scenes, though. And it's, you know, I thought the Eagles were extremely well done, and the whole scene is really stunningly scored and photographed. So I really enjoyed it. And you know, it makes a perfect climax to part one of the film. I think what's really going to be a problem is part two, when Gandalf will disappear from the story, Gollum will be gone too, and the only real thing we'll have is Smaug. So I think we're going to have trouble in part two. But as far as part one was, like, I couldn't have been happier.
Well, you know, the thing is this, is that the problem with the sequence is that it is, after 3 hours, yet another sequence where a small band of heroes is fighting off the swarm of monsters. And at some point, it's a zero-sum thing. You know, it's on the order of Dragon Ball Z, where every episode is about a character deploying his final ultimate whoa boy killer attack, which doesn't work, and then the next episode is about the other side deploying his final ultimate whoa boy killer attack, and it goes on for that for like 20 episodes. After a point, there's nowhere left to go. Andrea, am I wrong there?
Jeez, how much Dragon Ball Z have you watched?
too much, Andrea, too much.
Apparently. Jeez. So, no, my problem was not so. My problem was not with the Eagles. My problem was not with the orcs or the wolves. My problem was, you know, them getting away from the goblins. By the way, who designed that place? All the rickety wooden bridges and paths all
the
over.
The same guy who designed the Death Star, obviously.
Well, how does that work?
It's a little ragged, but they call it home.
Yeah. But anyway, a big series of pulleys and winches. I don't understand how the hell they pulled that off. But anyway, that was where I was going, wait a minute. No. Now we're going to fall again. But we'll all be fine. No. But, no. I mean, the fighting with the orcs, I didn't have a problem. The eagles I loved, and I knew that was going to happen. I you know, did not know that, but, you know, as usual, I am unprepared for 3D, so I didn't know that that giant yellow moth was going to come fluttering right at me, and you know, I'm ducking and waving my hands in front of my face, going, ah, bug, get it out of my lap. So, no, I mean, you know, most of that I was fine with, but just, you know, and you know, whatever. They shouldn't have survived the fall. They shouldn't have survived that many goblins chasing them. They shouldn't have survived the platform that they were on. Shouldn't have remained upright if it fell that many times. Whatever. But whatever. It's a fantasy movie. You throw your, you know, disbelief out the window and you just keep going. But even that, for me, it was like, oh, no. We've crossed a line somewhere.
Steve, well, before I get to the question for you, I just wanted to say, did any of you notice in this film, well, Steve, you didn't see it in 3D, but did you notice no dust motes, the filmmaker's best friend in this film?
I didn't notice any dust motes. It didn't register with me as significant, but yeah, I see your point.
Yeah, so
there were embers.
Embers, yeah.
Oh yeah, there was a sequence with embers. So
there was
okay.
Fire. There were embers. There was a Wilhelm scream. I heard that.
Was there? Where?
Yes.
Where did it come?
It was at one of those scenes where all the goblins are there on all the pathways and people are fighting and somebody fell off of one of those bridges and went ah, and I'm like, ah, it's the Wilhelm scream. But anyway.
Okay, for you who are keeping score, you can now look for that sequence in the film. Steve, as far as Overload was concerned, anything particularly do it for you?
Well, I mean, I think I pretty much agree with you about what's going on, you know, with that climax. I think as a standalone sequence, it's pretty well done.
Mm-hmm.
As a climax, it's hard to be climactic when you're basically doing more of what you've been doing for 2.5 hours. You know, it seemed a bit contrived. Like the whole question was, how can we get Gandalf in a situation where he can't save things, so it'll be up to Bilbo. And, you know, I thought, how long is he going to be sitting in that tree with his staff dangling down, with the dwarves dangling from it? And it sure does seem like he could have found a way to do something about that or somehow solve that situation a little bit better. But, you know, we need him to be tied up for Bilbo. So it just struck me as a bit, as I say, contrived. I mean, what bothered me most about it was the return of the evil white orc leader guy, who for some reason Thorin assumes is dead. So Thorin is like the heroic equivalent of the Bond villain who just, you know, oh yeah, he's dead. I'm not going to see, you know, I saw him kill my father, blah, 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 blah. But it's not like I'm going to make sure that he's dead. Assume it, you know? So I thought that was, you know, just kind of lame from the get go.
Anything else spoilery anybody wants to talk about?
Well, I will say that one thing that was, you know, I did feel that watching this after watching the Fellowship of the Ring, you know, and thinking, okay, this is like a kid's book rather than a grown-up book, and feeling like every once in a while they would do something that made it a little more kid-friendly, like having the characters sing, which was sort of ignored in, you know, Fellowship of the Ring when they did sing in the book, or things like, you know, more humor. You know, more physical humor, or like little pratfall things, or sort of, you know, funny physical comedy things. Or, I never really appreciated and understood you before, but now I do. Let me embrace you in a man hug. Like, oh. Sit down with the man hugging. All right, all right. Now they're bros. I get it. Oh.
That's,
well,
that's
they needed to lend some sense, like there had been a dramatic turning point, so we could justify calling this an ending versus just it was another action scene.
Yeah. Right.
So I give them credit for trying to make it a story point that at last Bilbo has proven his worth to the group. But, you know, I mean, it was nice they tried that, but I felt that stuff was more organic and believable in, you know, the Lord of the Rings movies. You know, I've just been rewatching them, and every time, well, maybe not every time, but in most of the action sequences, I felt something was at stake, or some, you know, dramatic turning point was at hand. You know, the bit at the end of Lord of the Rings with Boromir, you know, the one that we were suspicious of and, you know, maybe was going to turn out to be the bad guy and then he doesn't. You know, that's a big, you know, dramatic moment, and it's not a man hug and, oh, how could I have been so wrong about you? You know.
Larry, do you think the bro embrace was earned?
Yes, I do. In fact, you know, the improvement here is that a lot of these things are added by the script here. So the, you know, the whole conflict between Bilbo and Thorin doesn't really happen in the book. I mean, the sort of dwarves group collectively dislike Bilbo and think he's not maybe not worth anything, but here it becomes more focused on Thorin himself and Bilbo. And, you know, Thorin, right after they come out of the goblin thing, you know, Thorin is saying, you should have gone back to the Shire, you shouldn't even be with us. And so Bilbo, that really, I think, adds to the ending where finally he saves Thorin, and Thorin, you know, approaches him and he says, oh, you know, why did you do that? And I thought that was very emotionally moving. And also, as I said, they added the whole character of the pale dwarf in Thorin and that conflict too. And then, you know, they added all these conflicts that are not in the book. The whole thing with the elves and the dwarves disagreeing was not in the book either. So I think all these things really enriched it for me. And, you know, the whole tone of the movie. I think, as I keep saying, though, there's going to be a real problem in part two, because one of the problems in the book is, you know, Gandalf goes off and disappears, and when it's one book, it's all right, but, you know, Gandalf is pretty much in this whole movie. He's actually the central character, so next time he's going to be off doing something else, probably. We're going to miss him, I have a feeling.
Oh, he'll be there. They're just going to film his battle with the Necromancer. I think there's no doubt.
Yeah, but it's not going to be that, you know, that's one battle. He's still going to go off, and you're going to have a lot more.
They're going to Dragon Ball Z it. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think they've proven in this film that they're willing to drag it out.
Okay, before we do anything, Larry, we're getting close to time for you. Do you want to excuse yourself at this point?
I guess we're almost done, right? So
yeah, we are. We're close to it anyway. So you want to give us your rating, and then you can toddle off. It's going to be in the spoiler, but I guess I'll repeat it outside of the spoiler.
All right. Well, as you know, I obviously liked the film a lot, and I thought it was extremely well done, as usual with Peter Jackson's expertise in filmmaking style. I thought that was brought out by one scene early in the movie where Richard Armitage does a wonderful singing bit with the Misty Mountain song, and Peter Jackson films it in these slow panning shots, sort of going to each dwarf. Then he pans up to the chimney and the embers coming out. And I thought that was just a lovely moment and a very poetic moment. And of course, it's Tolkien's lyrics. So I thought that just is indicative of the whole quality he brings to the movie. So I'm going to give it a solid five stars.
Okay. And before you go, you want to tell everybody where you're going so we can all be jealous?
I'm going to see Django Unchained. Mm. So hopefully that'll be an exciting movie.
Okay.
Better than you guys thought of The Hobbit.
I could say it couldn't be any worse, but that's being a little too severe on The Hobbit. We'll get to that with the ratings a little later. But Larry, enjoy it.
Okay, see you next week.
Thank you, Larry. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so before we get out of the spoiler section, is there anything else spoilery we want to talk about?
Well, I guess they don't reveal it here, but, you know, in the book, The Hobbit, the necromancer is just a plot device because we need to get Gandalf off screen to create suspense. We need Bilbo and the dwarves without him to bail them out of everything. So the necromancer is just something that's mentioned. Mm-hmm. Like, well, where was Gandalf all the time? Well, there was this necromancer I had to deal with. And, you know, retconning in Lord of the Rings, we learn that he's actually Sauron, an early manifestation. So, you know, they're already setting that up, you know, and it's another one of those things that it's not about The Hobbit. It kind of just detracts from, you know, what should be the main narrative. And, you know, clearly they're setting that up so that in part two or part three, we can have the big battle between Gandalf and Sauron as the necromancer. So that's a little bit of a spoiler. And you know, I can see the temptation there of, well, we don't want Gandalf to disappear from the movie for a long period of time. But I think it's just going to be another thing that, you know, sends us off in another direction away from what the story should be. Yeah.
Could be a problem. And before we get out, this isn't really spoilery, but I can't think of anywhere else to put this. But and Steve, this is more addressed to you, although Andrea, you can chip in if you want. But I just wanted to ask you, Steve, your opinion. How long do you think it took before the people at WIDA started referring to the Goblin King as King Scrotum Beard?
I have no idea.
You know they had to have been doing that.
Maybe nope. We know no
have
such
a potato,
thing, Dan.
Yeah, okay,
moving have a potato.
On.
Not everybody lives in your head, Dan.
Well, thank God, because there's not enough room in here for me.
Well, it's too full of Dragon Ball Z episodes, apparently.
Yeah, clearly. Are we done with the spoilers?
Yes.
Okay, so we shall get out of the spoilers section now. And we're back from the spoiler section. If you skipped over it, you might want to go back and listen to it because we cover some real interesting spoilery things in there after you have seen The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. During that time, Larry had to leave us to go to a screening. So we thank him once again for joining us. But now it's time for the ratings. So Andrea, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey, 0 to 5 stars. What do you want to give it?
Well, do you want to give Larry's rating first?
No,
he gave it in spoilers.
We'll do it. We'll do it in the order it's usually done. So
okay.
he's usually at the end. So Andrea and guests first anyway. So
thank you. I am giving it 3 out of 5 stars.
Okay. How about you, Steve?
Well, it for me, it continues the decline. So if you remember my ratings from the Lord of the Rings films, which went from 5 to 4 to 3, I'm going to give this a 2, which is I don't really recommend you see it unless you feel you have to and you're a fan. And yeah, there's enough good stuff in there to make it worth your while, but it's not a film worth recommending strongly at all.
Yeah, I'm with you on this. I'd give it 2 stars as well, with once again the caveat that my judgment may have been skewed at least a little bit by the high frame rate projection system, but it's a slog and a not particularly rewarding slog, I thought. We talked a little bit about this in the spoilers, but maybe we can do this a little non-spoilery here. You know, as we've been going through with the entire discussion, we've been talking about the fact that this is one little tiny book being stretched out into a mammoth, probably 9-hour epic. What can we expect from the next 2 chapters if this is what's being laid down? Andrea?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If it's going to be padded with bits and pieces of different things, I when I was reading the book, I was trying to figure out where the cutoff would be between each thing, but it's not like it's cut neatly into thirds. So, I mean, I thought originally that I was trying to figure out what the third would be, and then I thought, okay, maybe the third portion is going to be just saved for the dragon. But then you thought the dragon would be in the second portion,
mm-hmm.
So then I thought that that meant that the third portion, they're just counting out the gold very slowly.
Well, there is a whole battle that comes at the end of the books.
But one entire movie devoted to one battle?
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Steve, as Andrea pointed out, I mean, they do tease Smaug at the end of this film, so I'm presuming that he, you know, hopefully they're not going to do the thing where they tease him at the end of this and then he shows up at the beginning of the next film and then disappears to show up at the end of the second film, which is also an option, but I'm sort of suspecting that the second film will be centering around Smaug. What do you think we're looking at for these next 2 chapters?
Well, as I said in spoilers, I suspect we're going to have a battle there. I don't know that's going to be enough to fill up the whole movie. Part 2 is called The Desolation of Smaug. I don't know if that means the desolation caused by Smaug or caused to him. So, I mean, if they kill him off, that's kind of like robbing, you know, the climax. But they need something to climax Part 2. And, yeah, so maybe they will just stretch out the battle and the gold counting and put in, when they first announced The Hobbit, it was going to be 2 films. It was going to be mm-hmm. The Hobbit and then another movie bridging, you know, taking us from the end of The Hobbit to the beginning of Lord of the Rings. And I'm wondering whether there is leftover material from that concept that they're saying they can put into a third movie to you know, thread it, you know, mm-hmm. tie the knot between the ending of The Hobbit and the beginning of The Lord of the Rings.
Or, you know, they could break it up into 4 movies, and then in the
Shut up,
movie,
Andrea!
And then the 4th movie is just Gandalf writing in his diary about what happened.
Right. But actually Bilbo. Bilbo writing his book there and back again.
There you go. We'll just look over his shoulder.
Yeah,
he's
we'll
writing
look over
the
his shoulder.
Thing.
For It would be like the, yeah, it'd be like some really avant-garde movie. He
they
would
could
just read it
Coen
to us.
They could bring in the Coen brothers. They could do Barton Fink in Middle Earth.
Yeah.
There you go.
But, you know, let me take the opposite tack, Steve, and just suggest that, you know, it's not too late. They've shot everything from what I understand. There's, I think, still enough time to have second thoughts and cut these down, you know, presuming they're going to stick to their guns on 2 more films, but they could still just be 2-hour films. Do you think there's any likelihood of that?
Not with Peter Jackson. No.
Come on, would it kill him to make a two-hour film?
I mean, yes. Look at King Kong. What excuse was there that King Kong be 3 hours long?
Yeah, yeah.
Other than that, you know, he's the 8,000-pound gorilla who does whatever he wants, you know.
Are you talking about King Kong or Peter Jackson?
I left that deliberately ambiguous. I did not clarify.
Okay. moving on. Before we go, let's just go through what is coming to theaters this Friday, December 21st, and holly jolly to us all. And turns out, really, not all that much. No real big tentpole openings. The one actual original film is Cirque du Soleil, Worlds Away, which is being typed as a fantasy on IMDb. It's a 3D film shot in, I believe, the James Cameron 3D system. So Cirque du Soleil had tried this before. The results really dependent on how much you like Cirque du Soleil to begin with. I happen to like them quite a lot, but it was sort of a tenuous story. As the actual live Cirque performances are, it's a tenuous story that stitches together a number of acts. I'm sort of suspecting that this is going to be the same thing. And then also coming on December 21st is the 3D re-release of Finding Nemo, and I don't know about
Monsters.
Oh, wait, is it it's fine.
We've already seen Finding Nemo.
You saw Finding Nemo.
Is it Monsters Incorporated?
Yeah, Monsters, yes. Inc., the original.
Monsters, Inc., okay. It's Monsters, Inc., okay. Jeez.
To get ready for the new Monsters University.
I looked at the title, and I guess, I completely blanked on it, and unfortunately I didn't include it in my notes because I was so certain of what it was going to be. So it's Monsters, Inc., in 3D. And you know what? I mean, Monsters, Inc. was a very good film, one of the top Pixar films in that upper level that's crowded with a lot of Pixar.
They're all top Pixar films till we get to Cars 2 and Brave.
Yeah, I would agree with I would throw in an argument for Toy Story 3 and Bugs, but generally speaking, yeah, that's very true. So I'd go and see this again in 3D. What about you? What about you, Steve?
Oh, of course, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been wanting to watch it, but I just won't put the DVD in the player because I know it's coming out in theaters in a week. So
you're definitely there.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I'm definitely there too, and we know what we're doing next week. Okay. That's cool. So that is what's coming next week to theaters. Before we go, Andrea, you want to bring audiences up to date on what's doing at BeABetterBookTalker.com?
I will. Dan, did you give Larry's rating?
Oh, no, I didn't. Sorry. Yeah, okay.
Because, to be fair, this way the audience should hear that we had a range of reviews.
That's true. That's true. And if you were listening to Larry's defense of the film prior, I think you can figure this out. But he did give it 5 stars. He was very impressed with it. He was appreciative of the depth that was brought to the story. And so
and he secured his bona fides as a member of the Peter Jackson tribe.
And Dan shared that positive review with you with great reluctance, like pulling teeth.
No.
Oh, yeah. And he thought it was.
Oh,
good
no,
too.
No. That would. I'm just sort of driving along to get us to the end before we hit an hour and a half, which we are close to doing anyway. So
it's appropriate considering we're doing Peter Jackson.
Yeah, it's a good thing it's not a 3 hour long discussion.
It's a the review has gone meta, folks.
Uh-oh. Okay, so swing by the Be a Better Book Talker podcast and visit BeABetterBookTalker.com, the website. Learn how to entice reluctant readers. The latest episode of my podcast, you can find a list of my favorite teen books of 2012, including several books that should be turned into movies that we could one day discuss on CineFantastique.
Okay.
And also, I will give a plug to TempleOfBad.com. Mother, Dan laughs every time I promote it. It's his frigging show.
Yes, I know. That's why I laugh.
He giggles girlishly and blushes. To learn more about a monthly podcast in which Dan Persons, Kevin Lauderdale, and I discuss movies so bad they're good, our next episode is already recorded and is soon to be released. It's going to be about the 1960s classic, quote, sci-fi film Mars Needs Women. And joining us for our discussion is very special guest star, Steve Bedrowski. Woohoo!
Hey. So yeah, we're all together again, and that'll be up in a few weeks. And so before we go, let me just point out that if you want to comment, girlish!
Delayed reaction theater.
Yeah.
Coquettishly.
Hey, okay, thank you, Steve. That's better.
Yes.
If you want to comment on anything you've heard in the show or regarding anything regarding genre film at all, you can send that email to podcast@cinefantastiqueonline.com. That's it for the show. Andrea Lipinski, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
Steve Bedrowski, thank you as well.
Oh, you're welcome.
Lawrence French, thank you too, wherever you are. And I am Dan Persons. Thank you everyone for listening. And remember, greet every day with a sense of wonder.
This has been a production of Upstart Company NYC, copyright 2012, Dan Persons, all rights reserved, no unauthorized duplication permitted.